Welcome to this edition of This is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world.
Greetings, this is Dave Gilmore, and this is Design Intelligence. Joining me today in the studio are Blaine Wishart and Tyler Goss, both two close friends of the Design Intelligence family. We are starting a series that we'll be doing over this coming year of speaking about deep and dark and high and light topics. It's wonderful being here with both of you. Thank you for taking the time to be with us here at This is Design Intelligence. Let me begin. There's deep and meaningful problems, root causes, maybe inhibiting challenges that are seemingly preventing the built environment industry from making the transformative leaps like we see in other industries. Manufacturing has done unbelievable things. Distribution has certainly come to the fore as we've watched in this COVID-19 period, the fantastic leaps in supply chain and distribution that have occurred, at least here in the United States. And high tech is always making leaps. What do we have to say about this regarding our industry? What's in the way of us making these leaps? Tyler, you want to take a shot at that?
You know, I've spent the last decade of my career trying to make the process from concept to occupancy of a building, trying to make that process more efficient and more effective. And you know, what I thought at the outset of the decade was, well, these are obviously problems. They're problems that everyone sees. They're inefficiencies. There's waste. There's all of this old school practice that's happening. And surely, once I point out all of these things, everyone else will see them as well, and they'll all work to fix it, right? You know, this is sort of the premise of the entire BIM VDC ecosystem in our industry. What I realized over the last, after about 3 or 4 years of this, is that, well, the inefficiency is actually profitable for a lot of people in the value chain of design and construction. There is instead of it being just passive resistance to change, there's actually active resistance to change I see in the industry. People who are making too much money off of inadequate drawings, off of the inability of an owner to intelligently and expertly look at the output of their contracted company, their contracted architects and engineers and contractors, to understand that it's being done inefficiently. There's so much money to be made in that, in all of those processes, that it ends up you end up with a lot of resistance, a lot of folks who are profiting from these inefficiencies, trying to resist the actual change. And then you pile on top of that all of the problems that you face in an incredibly localized industry, with lots of regulatory, complex regulatory oversight, with that has to, do things in atoms, not bits, so it can't scale the same way a tech industry can. You end up with just this, the perfect storm of inability to change, inability to progress and move forward under the current structure of the AEC industry as we know it.
Wow. Yeah. Blaine, some thoughts?
Well, certainly there's a lot to recommend this notion that there's a lot of profit being made by keeping things kind of backward and slow. Certainly in California, for instance, if somebody wants to build a house with a steel frame, it's pretty hard to do because the local contractors don't know how to do it and probably have local regulations against it. When we think about these things of regulations, how they hold us back, I think one of the key things is not so much whether or not there are regulations or stated goals, but whether or not they're connected to performance versus how to do things. So if the in a certain area, there's a regulation that doesn't allow you to not clean up all your waste or to fill the landfill with toxic waste. That's one thing. It's an entirely different thing to have regulations about how framing gets done. But I think there's something, for me, something else to think about. And that is it's true that other industries move much faster than AEC. But it's not clear to me that that speed is necessarily a good thing. So, for instance, an enormous amount of the rapidity with which we can produce various kinds of commodities uses way more energy than it should, produces a lot of waste that can't be recycled, and isn't based on recycling existing materials. So I'm not sure that speed is the only thing we're after. I don't think manufacturing industries actually have done a very good job. Another example would be that the context in which they operate is probably poor. If in North America we had a power grid that used high voltage lines so that we could leverage power in Baja California to provide power to a steel mill in Pennsylvania, we'd have quite a bit different situation. So a lot of the constraints we have are, I think, because we don't encourage planning and thought at the right scale. That becomes particularly important when you look at the differences between buildings we're building now, let's talk about Italy, and buildings they built 500 years ago in Italy. The buildings they built 500 years ago are still standing. They were designed to be up for hundreds of years. The buildings we're building now in Italy, they don't have that characteristic. So the problem isn't just in the United States. It's actually a very widespread problem. So I think that the financial incentives for planning on the 30-year level aren't in place, and they certainly aren't in place for planning on the 300-year level. And I think if they were, that the innovation would have would be more likely to take place.
Mm. Well, that really raises the question of ethics to me, because there really is an ethical dynamic there. Do we build in obsolescence, which maybe as a manufacturer sounds great because I keep giving a repeat sale, but at the end of the day, the downside, the damage, whether it's to the consumer or to the pocketbook of the consumer, to the landfills, and many other dimensions of society are so ruined by this obsolescence that's constantly being trashed and tossed out while we consume and consume and consume to rebuild and do more. It really is fundamentally an ethical question about the economic of this environment. Am I right? Am I off? Am I on? Help.
I want to push back on one thing that one concept that Blaine brought up, and then I want to agree with him and expand another one. I think there's a survivorship bias fallacy in the notion that, you know, we built more intelligently 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, or whatever. The Parthenon is still standing. The Via Medici is still standing. The problem there is that let's look at the economic construct under which those buildings were produced, right? We are looking at the architecture of the Duomo, of all the stuff. We are looking at the buildings that were built at great expense, at great physical expense to the working class, at great, to the serf class, at great monetary expense to the money class, the aristocracy, and they have survived, right? Great, let's celebrate that. Yes, they planned for a longer term, and they built for a longer term. What we don't see from that era is we don't see the worker housing, we don't see the vast swaths of human suffering that caused this to be caused this kind of architecture to take place. So I don't know that returning to that kind of planning horizon really works if you want to think about producing shelter for 8 to 9 to 10 billion people that we're going to have to provide over the next 100 years. You know, I think that there is something valuable to a dynamic and ever reproducing built environment that that sort of moves the cycle of life as opposed to this, you know, sort of geological scale that some of our great buildings in the past have grown at. And that being said, like the one thing, so that point aside, I do think that there's something valuable in really understanding that manufacturing has, you know, while we talk about them having these great innovations and you know, creating this great productivity leaps that have happened, the problem there, I think it's really valuable what you said, Blaine, which is the idea that all of these externalities, the waste externalities of of the process of producing our consumer goods and our cars and our iPhones and so forth have been externalized, have been they're actually geographically moved away from us. You know, you think about the pollution that comes from a gasoline engine car, it happens right there. You can see it as the consumer. You can see it happening. You're aware of it. But you don't think about when you buy an electric car is what is the cost of human life that's to mine the lithium to go into those batteries. What is the cost of transporting the nickel and the cadmium from mines in Canada and Bolivia and so forth and so on to come to your car? And then how is that electricity that your car is consuming? How is that produced? You know, that could be, you know, the if it's being produced by a coal or an oil facility that is, you know, 50 miles away from you, but, you know, by the way, is actually close to a lot of poor people who then have to inhale all of that pollution. So I think that a lot of the improvements in productivity we've seen in manufacturing have come at the cost of transporting the waste and transporting the inefficiency to a place where we can't see it as the end user of that product.
Blaine, response back?
Tyler, your comments were great. I think that there's a difference here. When I think of a building in Italy, I think of the houses my friends live in, not the Duomo. And the difference is perfectly understandable. So that I think that a lot of the dwellings I'm talking about that I view as being very livable and things that can be recreated in our context are made out of local materials, are aimed at human scaled dwellings, and again, local materials. But your comments about the effect of something like the big grandiose construction are really good. And thinking about the full human dimension of what it takes to put something like that together is a really sound perspective.
I live in a home, or I should say, we have a home in Massachusetts that this summer turns 227 years old. It's a New England clapboard home that has the original foundations in it. It has the original beams from 227 years ago still in the house. It took no slave labor or serf labor. It produced almost zero waste, and yet it continues to stand. It had what we often refer to as New England efficiency built into every nook and cranny of this building. So I don't believe that sustainable structures require kind of where you went with your comments of serfdom and outsourcing the pain and suffering to a non-visible site. I don't believe that that's necessary in all construction. I think that there are opportunities for us to think smarter using former construction methods and a former consciousness toward the preciousness of natural resources, which is what they did when they build homes in New England. It's a great discussion. It raises a lot of questions. Let's talk a bit about technology, this phenomenon called artificial intelligence, AI. Is there such a thing actually operating today, authentic artificial intelligence, Blaine?
Well, I think that the term is used in two wildly different ways. And one kind of use is a machine of some kind, an artificial device, replacing normal human intelligence. And that's quite common and increasing. The other way in which it's used is talking about general human intelligence, the same kind of capacity that an infant has that they don't lose until they get, you know, a little bit older than I am in terms of how they learned things. And there we're not close. We're not close to having a machine that is some kind of computational device that without direction can pick up a language like a two-year-old can, and nor can they pick up four languages like a two-year-old in India could. So we're not close on that. We're not close to having something that can anticipate problems and figure out a solution like a human being can. We're not close to that. And whether or not we could be close in 20 years, of course, there's tremendous difference philosophically and in terms of practice. But I don't see any data that shows that we're getting close to that. I don't think we're about to have a computer that will approach the problem of how do you come up with how do you handle the pressures in northern China on population increases with their terrible climate pattern they have up there? You know, that you don't find anybody in a Google lab or a Baidu lab unleashing an AI to come to grips with that problem.
So when we're talking about AI, as is regularly spouted in the press, what are they really saying? Is it really the sorting of data to try to find rational patterns and maybe non-intuitive patterns? Is it really toward what we often refer to as augmented human intelligence?
I think that's a great way to think about things. For instance, I was just looking at some research from Google trying to leverage the fact that they can, the mobile devices are so powerful now that machine learning can take place at the device level. And in fact, instead of having to ship a lot of data to some centralized server someplace, your phone can actually do things like learn better ways of suggesting what you're going to type next. So they're clearly, the intelligence is being augmented. The machine is thinking about things I'm not even thinking of and still doing them for me. And in that sense, my typing speed can go way up. My accuracy can go way up because of machine learning about my particular problems with the way I type on my phone, not yours or Tyler's. Okay. So that to me is very, very cool. Okay. But it's not the same thing as having the machine learn Mandarin.
Yeah.
It's not a sort of a singularity, consciousness intelligence of a machine that we're really talking about here. But I think Blaine is right on that. There's going to be a machine learning or artificial intelligence or whatever you want to call it. There's going to be a layer of that computation that happens between you and your devices. Increasingly, really interestingly, this is happening a lot in the photography space, right? That your phone has become the most important camera you have. I'm an avid photographer. I have a great 35 millimeter body with all these great lenses. I don't use it anymore because I can get better results from my iPhone now than I can with my camera. And that's a lot of that is down to the machine learning processing that's happening completely transparently to me, hidden from me, just in the layer between me and the device. If you look at the metadata, if you download photos data from your Apple device, from your iPhone, and you look at the parameters associated with every picture, there are all of these machine learning parameters that you don't ever see. One of them is my favorite is there's actually a pleasantness or pleasingness metric associated with every photo. So what Apple's actually doing when they take a photo now is it's doing a burst. It's taking, you see that you have a live photo, it sort of gives you like a second or half a second of animation. It's taking all of those frames and figuring out which one of those frames in the 24 it's taking when you press the take photo button is the most pleasing. And then that's the one it presents to you as the photo you took, right? So there is this augmentation that's happening that you're not aware of, but makes you actually feel better about yourself because you've taken a better photo. And I think the same thing along the lines of, let's bring that back to the AEC industry. Are there tools, is there a software company or someone working to insert an artificial intelligence layer between you and your output, whether it's a drawing or a model or whatever, that is improving it as you're drawing it, as making it better, as making it more pleasing, more aligned with best practices, aligned with code. All of those things are things that are going to be happening in the next 3 to 5 years in our software, I think. The big question I have there is who is going to take responsibility and accountability for what is better, right?
Yes.
With a photo, it's easy because, that's a bit more, there's no stakes to a photo. There's really no stakes to a photo unless you're a professional photographer. If an artificial intelligence layer inserts itself in the building process and as a result causes something to be built less well, that's a problem. So who is going, like, how do you create accountability pathways for that kind of layer of intelligence?
So I have one proposal along those lines. It's a really good question. So in March, I traveled from rural China to London. And in order to do that, I had to check into a hotel in a rural area in China where nobody spoke English. And the check-in process was quite simple because of the power of Baidu Translate. When I got to England, checking in was a little bit difficult because of my difficulty with English accents. So here's my phone that has been largely trained by massive amounts of data of people speaking in Chinese and English. Now, I think there's an analog to that and the building environment. For example, I would like to see, as input, plans for buildings, as input, data collected from the real-time operation of that building, with the goal being things like, are the design direction from the standpoint of energy use, is that being met in the real-life building? And I think that just like Baidu and Google collect literally millions and millions of conversations to improve constantly their translation, I think that whether or not our designs meet the goals of the design in the building as it actually exists 1 year, 5 years, and 10 years after it was constructed, I think that's quite possible. But it means placing sensors into the built environment, and it means essentially instrumenting the designs themselves for those kinds of goals.
Yeah, and then the interesting challenge there too, I think, is one of scale. You talk about hundreds of millions, billions of conversations that are being recorded with people who have one foot in the world of software development and one foot in the world of architecture and design. You know, we don't have a solid enough foundation in the computer science necessary to understand how to scrape that kind of data at scale and schematize it in a way where we can create actionable results from it. Right. It's just it doesn't fit into the paradigm of what we believe to be sort of the computational world, which is, you know, the tangible computer in front of us, or you know, single threaded. This is a conversation I was having yesterday, that all of our processes, our computational innovations in AEC are really predicated on sort of a single threaded Windows environment, and that doesn't allow us to munge and then compute against large scale, large quantities of data that you're going to need to create that kind of actionable insight.
So let us pretend that a firm who does 100 projects a year, which is not a radical number at all, so does 100 projects a year, and they were able to build into their contracts occupancy evaluation, ongoing, consistent occupancy evaluation that would really speak to the performance of the building. And I'm not talking about just energy performance. There's so many other aspects of performance. Seems like we're always myopically focused on just the energy performance. And I understand that because of the carbon footprint, but there's so many more pieces to this. But let us pretend that we are measuring multiple dimensions of occupancy performance against all 100 of those projects. Is that enough data for that firm to particularly do what we were earlier describing, for the machine to learn and for them to set their own parameters on what they believe best is, best design is, best outcomes, and then to allow the machine to then say, based upon these 100 designs, this is how close you got to it or where your gaps were. Am I making sense?
I think that the way you frame that question, though, kind of brings up, I think, a deeper problem, which is the idea that a single firm can create a proprietary and should create a proprietary competitive advantage over their ability to build performant buildings. That's, you know, then, so that firm builds 100 buildings, let's say, in 1 year, 100 projects in 1 year. They're so successful and they're so good at hitting their targets that they get to build 150 the next year, and they get to build 225 the year after that. And they get to grab more architects, more people, and, you know, they grow larger and larger. They become an SOM. They become a Gensler. Then we've still only a liberal guess. So, you know, like, we've still only affected 5 to 10 million square feet of the built environment, Right? Is that really is the idea that we should compete on our ability to build performant buildings really the way to go here? I don't think it is. I think that the way I would form that question is there a way that we can measure in a standardized and schematized way the performance of the entire built environment or the entire constructed environment over the course of a year, and then give that information or share that information across all these firms to then go and do with it what they will? I don't think you get the scale of impact if you have it, if you place the onus of doing the analysis and output at the scale, at the level of the firm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Blaine, some comments?
Well, that perspective seems really valuable to me. When I think back to how voice recognition started, you know, initially they were looking at the voices of one or two people and making very modest progress. And I don't think that model is wrong. I think it has the limitation of not going to scale, as Tyler just pointed out. It doesn't mean to me that for some well-funded firms, it's not worth doing what Dave just described. But to really go somewhere and set a high standard, I like the idea of looking at what exists and measuring what exists, and then making that data available to people. Knowing this, will that inform your design process? Eventually wanting to have a feedback loop, but that seems really valuable. I guess one of the things that I think of, you know, here is the definition of built environment's a little bit difficult, but I think we're seeing that we're not precise yet, but as we go to a different level of autonomy when it comes to the behavior of vehicles, that there's a synergy between what the car learns about its environment and how we make the environment that the car is operating in smarter and learn from it to reach higher levels of autonomy from the standpoint of the vehicles. I don't think there's some fixed level at which it's autonomous enough to call autonomous. I think every incremental step forward has that character. And so one of the things that we have then that is important is that Tesla designed their cars to collect data to inform their design in the future. And I think something analogous can take place inside other parts of the built environment, particularly dwellings and office buildings, to give them that character where part of the design is the collection of data. And if you look at the hardware designs over the last, you know, say 50 years, a big part of what's taken place that allows the incredible speed of today's computers is increasingly making them introspective about their own behavior.
It's interesting, too, that they, you know, I saw a presentation by a gentleman named Paul Newman, not the actor. He's actually a roboticist who teaches at Oxford, and he's one of the people who actually who came up with a lot of the algorithms that allow self-driving cars to correct their course and so forth and so on. And he talked about creating a market for corner case resolution in the autonomous vehicle realm. And what corner case resolution is basically like the car hits a situation where it doesn't understand how to resolve, you know, the conditions it sees around itself, then turns itself over back to the driver. The driver resolves it. All of a sudden, that's a product. Right, that resolution is something that specific car can then sell to all the other cars, all the other autonomous cars on the market. Like, hey, I have this great solution to this situation. You know, it's worth 35 cents, right, and per vehicle. It could be this automated market, just like we have the Facebook auction market. They had the instantaneous auction they do for ad space. Now, like, let's transpose that to the AEC industry. If you, as an architect, as a designer, come up with a solution that increases the performance of a building along any of the metrics you described, Dave, if you do that, all of a sudden, that's a product that you could create a market for these micro, like these nano design decisions that are happening in your process that can then be sold and re distributed and transmitted to all of the other firms in the world, or like again to that machine learning layer that's inserting itself between us and our tools. And all of a sudden, everyone benefits. And the person who came up with the idea, who came up with that resolution of that that difficult problem, or their firm gets compensated for that resolution.
It provides a very interesting incentive for not only being inventive and innovative, but also being open and transparent and sharing. It really creates something wonderful, as opposed to keeping it secret, trying to say that your competitive advantage, when the reality is it really isn't, and being able to open it up. What a powerful thought. What a great idea that is.
What I'm interested in primarily with respect to technology is what are new businesses or new models of revenue models that, that architects, engineers, contractors can create using leveraging this the novelty of these technologies that step outside of the traditional patronage model of building construction. Because that's how we get to the future of the firm, the future of what the industry looks like. We don't get there by just trying to get a few more contracts this year than we did last. We have to think, okay, how can we be an entirely different business? How can we be in the product business? How can we be in the micro idea business? So sort of like what the ideas behind what Ian Keogh is doing with HiPar and such. I'd like to turn back to what this means for the future of firms.
Well, I think it's so fantastic. It's interesting. So that you know, this morning I had a phone call with a regional construction company that runs almost $2 billion in total construction value on an annual year-over-year basis. And they were asking me, the leadership of this firm was asking, we realize, which in and of itself was unbelievably enlightening, we realize that the way that we've been operating for these many decades is no longer relevant. Whoa, what a powerful thought, right? And we're asking, what should we become? Oh my gosh, if I could take and bottle up that decades of experience and insight and turn that inside out into what you're describing as a solutions firm, a product firm, a problem-solving firm. By the way, we do construction too. What a powerful combination that becomes. And it truly becomes this wealth generator for society, not just the firm. Pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah. So something I proposed, it's interesting because it's something I proposed a few years ago with a large builder, general builder in the United States, was the idea of having an internal consulting group. So we were doing a lot of work in the realm of lean process management, innovation coaching, all this stuff to try to make our main business better. And what we realized is we created all of these process experts inside of the company. Then that was a thing we could then start to sell to our repeat customers. So, the hypothetical was we have a large pharmaceutical firm that needs to expand their research facility or believes they need to expand their research facility. We go in with our consulting team and look at how they're set up, how the stations are set up, how the space is used, et cetera, and try to figure out if there's a way we can reconfigure their existing facilities to perform at the scale they want to perform at, to meet the goals that they were otherwise going to have to build the building for. And my idea with this was, okay, well, if we can figure out how to, for our customers to not build a building, then we don't have to incur the risk of building a building. We can then, from a business perspective, we can take a consulting fee equivalent to the profit we would have made on a new building by giving them a way to figure out how to do this without building a new building. Mm-hmm. This didn't go over very well, as you can probably imagine, sort of what I was leading to, because they saw themselves as builders. They saw themselves as muddy boots. Their image of themselves was, the muddy boot superintendent who is out there and solving construction problems in the field on a daily basis, which is actually a symptom of the disease, not really the sort of, it was not something we should heroically celebrate. But because they saw themselves as muddy boots builders and not knowledge workers, which is what they really were, because they were a construction management firm, they couldn't make the leap to say, okay, maybe if we take our expertise and turn it this other direction, we can, you know, we can do something that's much less risky, that has the same profit model, or profit potential that our mainline business does. And then all of a sudden we've created a new business. We've created a new, we've turned ourselves into something larger and better than we are today.
So I really like this line of thinking. I have to confess, I'm not sure I have any great insight, but let me ask this question. It seems to me that part of what's implicit in this is that the expertise of people who actually know how to build things and design them needs to be opened up so it becomes a social resource. Because, and I'm very much struck by the problems we have in this area, where real estate prices are too high, zoning is too strict to allow new buildings. The tension between different sections of society who favor different modes of transportation and have a different idea of how a city street comes together is really quite intense. And there's would be a great value to having people who really knew a lot about transportation, about buildings, about homes, and so forth, mediating a social discussion over values. And I think there may be an analogy here to the way that, for instance, in Taiwan, they came to grips with the recent plague. It's been seen very much as a social process led by people with a background in a couple, specific technologies like epidemiology, medicine, and so forth. And because they created a social discussion that was led by people with the technical expertise to make decisions about quarantines, masks, lockdowns, and so forth, and do that in a way that got social acceptance, not social division. And I'm wondering if that kind of a process isn't appropriate to be led not by doctors in this case, not by nurses in this case, or public health people, but by people who really know how to build transportation systems, buildings, offices, and homes.
I think this is a great place for us to put a pause on our discussion and mark this entire time with a comma, because we are just scratching the surface. I have an idea that I'm going to pass by our producer, Laura Spells, about us doing this at least once a quarter, of us having some of these wandering but meaningful discussions about all things related to the built environment industry, as we have done here today. Would you both be willing to do that?
Well, Dave, you know me, I love a meandering conversation. It's where I live. So it's where my brain lives. So I am 100% in on that idea.
That's great.
And meandering is all I know how to do.
Well, you guys are just unbelievable. Well, I'm so glad the two of you joined me here today in the studio. Thank you both for being with me here today.
Thanks to both of you. I've really enjoyed this discussion, and I'm looking forward to more of the same.
Yeah, I would say exactly the same thing. It's always a pleasure. It's always an interesting conversation. I never know where it's going to go, but it always seems to go to a great place. So thank you, Dave, and thank you, Blaine.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This Is Design Intelligence, sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This Is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.